Welcome to Talking Up Music Education, a podcast from the NAMM Foundation. Talking Up Music Education podcast shares news and stories about music education from teachers, students, parents, school, and community leaders who care about music education and are working to create more opportunities for music learning. And now, here's your host, Mary Lurson.
Hi, everyone. This is Mary Lurson. I'm the executive director of the NAMM Foundation and your host here at Talking Up Music Education. We're very glad to be with you, and we must tell you that we're in the time zone where everyone is joined together in their homes and joined together across online platforms during the COVID-19 quarantine process. So far, people have done very well and have been very inspiring, and we're very grateful to be having some time today with one of our NAMM Foundation grantees from the Music Haven Project, Mandy Jackson. Hi, Mandy. Welcome.
Hi, Mary. Thank you so much for having me.
And where are you greeting us from? Just tell us where you're calling in from.
Calling in from New Haven, Connecticut.
And tell us about your organization, its background, who founded it, its primary programming. It was such a great project. Tell us about
it. Thank you. Absolutely. Music Haven was founded in 2006. We're in our 13th year of student programming. It was founded by a wonderful musician named Tina Lee Hidari, who really set out to figure out a different way to be a classical musician and engage in the community. And one of the things that makes our program a little different is that we're sort of based around the model, not just the model of, but an actual professional string quartet. So we have a string quartet where each of the musicians is a conservatory-trained professional musician, and each of them teaches and mentors a studio of 15 to 20 young musicians. And we have a longitudinal model, so our students start coming to us when they're 6 or 7 years old, and we expect them to stay with us through high school graduation. It's an after-school program. They come by school bus to our location, which is in the neighborhood of Fairhaven, Connecticut, which is one of the neighborhoods that we serve. And they'll come for one-on-one lessons, for group classes in music history, music theory, improvisation classes, and also ensembles. We have a variety of ensembles as well, chamber music coachings, and a variety of other activities. And we also offer supports in terms of tutoring, SAT prep, homework help, and we provide healthy snacks every day as well.
Wow. So you've had some graduates, right? If starting 13 years ago, you've had some students that made it all the way through, right?
A couple of waves, right? We've had 3 years of graduates, 3 cohorts of graduates. Fully 100% of them are enrolled in 4-year colleges, all received scholarships of various kinds. And some of them went into music, some of them went into other things, but continue to play music. And we're very proud of all of them.
Yeah, that's wonderful. At the NAMM Foundation, we funded Music Haven in 2 rounds. And I think we actually funded Music Haven right at its very beginning. And it was also one of the first sort of social justice projects. Am I correct in assessing it that way?
Absolutely, absolutely. So the only requirement, the only eligibility requirement for our students is that they are from low-income families. We do not have audition. It's sort of first come, first serve in that way. And we really exist to make sure that kids who otherwise wouldn't have a chance will have the opportunity to play an instrument, and not just play, but play at the highest level. Our teachers are excellent. They have very high expectations of our students. And it really comes through every time you hear the kids play. What we're doing at Music Haven is also a lot, it's about a lot more than music. Our kids are engaged in social action projects, playing in the community, and really learn how to build a whole bunch of skills that, as you know, help them in so many ways, regardless of whether they decide to go into music.
I think one of the first stories that greeted us when we were reviewing the project just in its very first years was that the string quartet, all came out of conservatory and wanted to establish themselves as a string quartet. And one of the first things they did was they played right in the neighborhood, right? They would rehearse. You know, it was just such a great visual of bringing their very lofty skills into a place where truly could benefit. Am I accurate in remembering that story?
Yeah, absolutely. When the organization first began, there really wasn't a physical space that the organization had as its own base. The lessons were taught at a couple of different school sites after school. and the quartet rehearsed wherever it could. Eventually, the organization acquired a small storefront space on Whaley Avenue in New Haven. And we've grown a lot over the last few years. And we actually now have a full programming space, again, in one of the neighborhoods that we serve, where the quartet will rehearse there each morning in normal times. Obviously, right now that's not happening. The quartet will rehearse each morning for a few hours. They perform a regular concert chamber music series. That's a ticketed concert series. And the ticket revenue goes back into our program. They also play concerts and provide workshops throughout the region. And when we do those for a fee, the revenue again is put back into our program. But the quartet also plays a lot of free concerts in the community throughout the year, and always has over the years, whether it's in, you know, community centers, neighborhood spaces, library branches. The idea is to get music into spaces that otherwise wouldn't be able to experience it.
Yeah, and there was really the first wave of a consciousness about the role of classical music in every day and every person's life, and bridging these gaps. It was a very, very inspiring. You know, classical musicians that come out of conservatory generally are headed into a kind of a narrow option, right? Be it in orchestral or academic. But a whole other idea sprung up from this quartet. So it's been very inspiring. How many students then? If you 12 to 15 students per player, so you have 60 or 70 enrolled?
Well, we actually now have besides our Haven String Quartet, we have one other musician that teaches regularly at Music Haven, a resident violinist, is also an exceptional musician who has a studio also of students and directs our beginner program or music bridge program, which is a way of bringing kids in a group class to see, you know, how they like it, how good of a match is the family before they sort of transition into our one-on-one lessons program. And so we currently have 81 students, and that's about as big as we can get. and that's because our model is really based on the relationships between student and teacher and teacher and family. And in order to build those relationships over the long term in a very deep way, we need to keep our programming size one where we really can get to know and meet the needs of all of our families.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful story that you're writing at the same time. So we have to talk about our frontline folks during this time and your decision and process to move your services away from person to person, right? You were forced with that like everyone else was in Connecticut. When did that happen and what did you do?
Well, in fact, we first started to get a sense that we were going to have to cease our in-person programming during a week that's usually a super exciting week for us, which is our recital week. Twice a year, once in November, once in March, each of our teachers hosts a recital and potluck dinner for his or her studio. And so all the families come together. We all have a recital, the kids play, and then we all have dinner together. And we, in fact, really quickly transitioned over the course of that one week, which was the last week we all were together, the second week in March. The first few nights we had our recitals with our potlucks, and then we started to hear some things on the news. We eliminated the potluck element. We thought it would be safer to not bring food and be sharing food. And then by the end of the week, we had to actually send everyone home. So it was a real sort of gradual realization that we were going to have to shift how we do things in a very significant way.
Wow, that's fast, right? It was fast for everyone. So then,
well, I think like a lot of people, we first heard that the schools would be closed for a few weeks, and then it just became clear that they weren't going to reopen anytime soon. One of the obstacles we have, though, is that, well, I have to say, the very first thing we did after the schools were shut down and our office was shut down is that we got together virtually as a team and made sure that we got in touch with every one of our families and had a conversation with our parents and guardians, sometimes with the students themselves, to make sure that everyone was okay, that everyone knew how to access food supports. All of our kids actually have free school lunch. And without being in school, we had to make sure they knew where they could go to get that food assistance. And we had to figure out who didn't have a computer or internet access at home. We also spent, you know, a good 2 weeks making sure everyone knew things like where to get information about testing or what to do if someone in their family was sick, or even making sure our families knew that our governor had issued a moratorium on utility shutoffs and evictions, because some of our families didn't know that information yet. So our first week or so was really just spent checking in with everyone to make sure they were okay.
So you were serving a vital social services link there, right? I mean, you were a trusted companion to these families, and you reached out, right? You didn't wait.
Absolutely. And we also found that, you know, the school system was also trying to reach out to families to do things like distribute technology. But what we found was, not surprisingly, you know, a lot of these families we've had close relationships with over 6, 7, 8, 9 years. Our students who come to us, those who have graduated, before they graduated, were with our organization for an average of almost 10 years. And so we found out that our relationships and our ability to get information from and to families was actually better than what the school system had. We had a closer link and a direct line of communication that the schools, the principals didn't actually have, and found ourselves communicating information to the school system about which families needed help, which families needed access to technology. And ultimately, the schools shut down their technology distribution, and we found ourselves securing donations of Chromebooks and distributing them to our families, driving around, dropping them off along with some bags of groceries and things like that.
Wow, it's just, you know, the value of an arts organization in a community, right? I mean, it's just
absolutely
really, really amazing. Great testament to your all dedication. So once the Chromebooks were in place and teachers were in place and enough Wi-Fi was flowing or hotspots, were children continued to be supported in lessons? What did that look like?
We actually, quite amazingly, didn't have any cessation in our lessons program. The first week that we were all at home, we didn't have every single student participating in a lesson, but we had, I would say, 60 to 65% of them, even that first week. The teachers were very resourceful and very creative about how they connected with the students and how they did their lessons. So a great example is one of our cello teacher came up with a plan of how to do lessons by exchanging YouTube videos with students. And for that, they only needed a smartphone and they didn't need to have Wi-Fi at home. They just needed to be able to either access data or get to a hotspot for the exchange of the videos. So the students would send him a video 2 or 3 minutes each day of the week. And then he actually recorded a video in response to each student where he talked about what they needed to work on and sent and uploaded that video to the YouTube channel he created. And this was a really good way of, in sort of a lower tech way, or a way that didn't require a computer and didn't necessarily require consistent Wi-Fi, of keeping that contact going.
And it's kept going, right? All the children are...
Yeah. By the end of the second week, we had pretty much everybody in regular lessons in one way or another, you know, based on the teacher and each family. Each of our teachers has really figured out what works best for each family. Mm-hmm. And so some are doing FaceTime, some are exchanging YouTube videos, some are even doing lessons over the phone when they can't get on the Wi-Fi. Some are doing Zoom lessons. One of our violin studios has had studio class each week. Playing in a group is difficult over Zoom with the delays and sort of their sound issues, but they've done things like showed off their pets to each other and talked about what they've been doing for the week. Just a way of seeing each other each week.
Yes, you are all commended for being so deliberate about this. You know, it's you're saving the spirit and the energy of these young people as they move through this time. You know, we're having enough of a difficult time as adults, right? Leading organizations, and to understand the perspective of children. You know, I don't think we really understand yet what they have gone through. So this musical lifeline is so great.
We've actually found that so many of our students have been very energized by and sort of inspired by the use of the technology. It's not the way they usually do lessons. And for some of them, it's been just an amazing jumpstart to their progress and their playing. For example, many of the students who are exchanging daily videos with their teacher, even though they're no longer having a full half hour or 45 minute or 16 minute lesson each week in person, because they're exchanging videos every single day, we've seen amazing progress with a lot of the students, and they'll get creative about what they do in their videos. Kids are incredibly resilient, especially our kids, and they really seize any opportunity to use technology and to be creative. So that's been really wonderful to see. One of the things that it has forced to happen, our students, most of them don't generally tune their own instruments. It's not an easy thing to do to tune a string instrument. We've had a few of our students actually learn over video with their teachers how to tune their instruments. They still need guidance to do it, but it was sort of out of necessity because usually when the kids come to us after school, the first thing the teachers do with each student is make sure they're in tune, and the student hands the instrument over to the teacher and the teacher tunes it. A couple of our students have really persisted and gotten the hang of doing that with guidance. In other cases, we've had to even do sort of a no contact exchange of an untuned instrument for a tuned instrument. It's a tricky situation with string instruments when we're not seeing in person, seeing the kids on a regular basis.
Yeah, well, that's great. You know, I think the whole online learning has set up a whole new thought process. What does individualized learning look like? Right? I mean, we've sort of been forced into thinking about that more, but it will never supplement the reality of being together, especially to make music and ensembles. So what are your plans for resuming? What do you think the timeline's going to be, and how do you think you're going to bring ensembles back together in the kind of safe new zone that we're all working to provide?
Yeah, that's a really difficult question, and I know everybody's thinking about it. The way our program is set up when we're in a normal time is that Fridays is when we have all of our big group classes. And so on Fridays, almost all of our kids are with us each week. That's when we have most of our ensemble rehearsals. And then the other days are mostly one-on-one lessons. And so there are fewer students there at a time. We're trying to think through, you know, we're hoping that in the fall we'll be able to return. We don't know. We have to take our cue from the school system for a number of reasons, not just because, you know, that's a good indication of when it's deemed safe, but also because our students rely on the school buses to take them to our location, and most of them won't be able to get there without school buses. And so we're not able to have our program operate when there isn't any school. But we're thinking through all different options of how to sort of restructure the program to have a sort of fewer students on site at once for as long as we need to, how to rearrange our space so that we can keep some social distancing if possible. It's sort of an open question right now, but at this point we are planning on returning in the fall when school starts. And we're gonna take our cues from the public health experts about what the different adaptations might be that we'll have to make. One of the biggest questions for us also is our quartet, our professional string quartet, has a regular performance series, and it's not clear when people are going to feel safe or when it's going to be deemed safe to resume something like a concert in a concert hall. And so we also have to figure out how and on what terms we can resume our live performance schedule, both for our quartet and for our students. I know that our teachers are now planning some virtual recitals with the students and looking into all different ways to showcase our students playing without being together physically. And everybody's having a lot of fun figuring out how to use different video tools. But we're really in the sort of information gathering stage in terms of figuring out how we resume our program.
Yes, I think we're all in the same boat that way. I mean, the whole concept of when will people be able to come together both to make music and to listen to music and to participate in all sorts of activities that are less than 6 feet apart from one another. You know, that's just part of, and we too are watching for the schools. And I also think we're working at the NAM Foundation to get a bead or get some understanding about what some best practices could be. Because most of all, we want this experience to be safe, right? I mean, we are moving through a time which is unprecedented. And how do we make it both safe and interesting and life-fulfilling and life full of learning that music is? So We'd love to stay in touch with you about that as you work with the big city school district, the New Haven Public Schools, and your role in it. I think you have a lot that you could share with a lot of us. So,
well, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. We can all learn a lot from each other.
Yeah, that's the story of this time too. So to wrap up, Mandy, what have been, you said you're a mom home with two little ones. What are their ages?
Well, they're not that little. They're bigger than I am almost. I have a 14-year-old and 11-year-old.
Well, those are tough ages too, right? They want to be on the move and go, 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 and being in their life. You know, as someone who's leading a really important arts organization there together with, and, you know, managing this music learning reality, what are some of your takeaways or lessons learned that you never thought you'd be learning at this time?
Well, I think what it's really done is reinforce some longstanding lessons that I feel like we learn in every crisis, but also in every triumph. The most important thing that's been clear through all of this is that it's all about relationships. To the extent that we've been able to keep our students engaged and be a support for our families, it's because of a long-term investment in the relationships with those students and their parents and guardians. And that's why they know that they can call us and ask us questions about things that have nothing to do with music, but also it's why the kids are eager to have whatever time they have with their teachers, whatever time they have with each other, even if it's not in person. The other thing that's very clear with the community that we serve is that this idea about there being normal times and a time when there is no crisis, that's not actually true for a lot of our families. A lot of our kids live in a state of distress, a state of crisis on a regular basis, and they're very resilient, they're very brave, they adapt, they're flexible, and sometimes the best comes out for some of them in a time of change, in a time of crisis, but also they have these needs in an ongoing way, even before this pandemic. And so we talk about, oh, when things return to normal, something that we constantly have to remind ourselves is that for some of our kids, there is really no normal, or that the crisis is the normal. And when we talk about figuring out how to help get them access to technology or access to food supports, that's something we've done in a much more concerted way over the last few months. But it's become clear that it's something for which there's a need all the time, and there has always been.
A re-immersion in the needs of the whole child, right? And a dedication to that every day through music.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, man, you've painted such a compelling picture for us with all the work that you're doing there and the precious children and young people that you work with every day. So I can't thank you enough. And we're so honored that the NAMM Foundation, I have to mention, it's through the Liz Reisman's Fund in the NAMM Foundation that our support flows to you. Liz was a very important NAMM member to us in Connecticut. Unfortunately, we lost her a little while ago. But she was so dedicated to the type of work that you're doing, as well as the social justice part of it. So thank you for carrying Liz with you in every action that you do everywhere.
Well, thank you so much. We are incredibly grateful for the support that we get from the NAMM Foundation. It really makes this work possible. And NAMM has specifically been supporting our one-on-one lessons. And that is a really unique opportunity for the kids we serve would otherwise never have the chance to have that kind of one-on-one instruction and mentoring. So that support is so vital.
And that's what Liz would be particularly happy about. So thank you, Mandy Jackson from Music Haven, and to all of you for being with us here on this episode of Talking Up Music Education, a podcast of the NAMM Foundation.
Talking Up Music Education is a podcast created by the NAMM Foundation. To learn more about how you can support music education in your community or how you can be part of the work of the NAMM Foundation, visit our website, www.namfoundation.org, or join us on Facebook at facebook.com/NAMM Foundation. You can also follow Mary on Twitter at Mary L. Namm. That's Mary L. N. A. M. M.